if we're going to be.
Okay, in the absence of other participants, why don't we get started? We'll take the gentleman from my right, and if we could ask each of them to introduce themselves and perhaps describe the nature of their paper this afternoon in about 2 minutes, and then we'll open it for questions.
We can't fill this room. Three professors accustomed to lecturing to large classes. With sad shape.
Okay, well, my paper concerned the effects of various radiations.
Yeah, if we could start by identifying names and...
Okay.
Yeah, see, they're 20 miles away.
My name is Robert Walker. I'm a professor of physics at Washington University, St. Louis. My paper had to deal with the effects of various kinds of radiation that hit the moon's surface, radiations that come in from outside the solar system called galactic cosmic rays, radiations that come from closer by from the sun. Two kinds of radiation come from the sun, solar flares, a burst of energetic particles which occur occasionally, and a solar wind, which I did not study, but one of the other panelists did, which doesn't penetrate very far and comes in at a very steady pace relative to the solar flares. A number of effects were observed. Perhaps the most interesting thing is that these nuclear particles actually register tracks as they go through the minerals. They disarrange the structure and leave a linear trail. And you can visualize these, you can grow these linear trails up to the point where you can see them, actually look through a microscope and see them, they look like lines, by putting the material in an acid etch. Perhaps the most significant thing from our work and from the other work on the panel, to me the most important thing, is here, in studying these kinds of radiations with different techniques, you're looking at the past history of the sun, the past history of the sun's composition via the solar wind, that's Professor Geiss, myself and Professor Arnold, the past history of solar flares. This is something that we have never been able to do. We are now able to do it because we have the lunar samples in our laboratory. It would not have been able to do remotely. It is unique to the moon, and it opens up a whole new area of scientific research.
I'm Professor James Arnold of the University of California at San Diego. I'm a spokesman for a Tolkien character called Shreldalf, Shreldalff, which is a composite of the 11 of us who did the particular effort on the rock 17. I don't know whether he's a dwarf or a wizard, but he's somewhere in between there. You can judge for yourself whether you think the quality of the work. It's a great pleasure this session to go after Professor Walker rather than before, because whereas I had to spend my time giving material which introduced his talk during the session, while he's done a lot of it for me. While Professor Walker's work has dealt with the particular technique of nuclear tracks and the very rich collection of phenomena develops there, our work is concerned with low level, or it now sounds better to say high sensitivity, radioactivity counting, measuring extremely minute amounts of radioactive substances in these rocks. And in this way, as Dr. Walker said, trying to get the basic information as to the cause of these radioactive isotopes that we've seen. We always compare the short-lived activities which have happened in the last 20 years, when all sorts of clever people have been measuring all sorts of things about the sun and the galaxy, with the long-lived ones that give us the fossil record. And the main conclusion of our work that we're able to say at this time, there's much more, I think, still to come, is that the solar flare particles and the galactic particles account very well, that is, known radiation seem to account adequately for what we have seen in the short-lived isotopes, the ones that give us the recent record. Then we can tell that the long record looks very similar. In other words, that solar protons, solar flares, sunspots have been going on for millions of years. That doesn't perhaps surprise anybody, but I think this is the first direct experimental evidence that this is true. And as I'd like to then repeat a bit, warn Bob that I was going to do this, of what he said, that we are here looking not only at the history of the moon, but at the history of the sun. As far as I am concerned, the whole ball game, the whole excitement of today, does not lie just in understanding the history of the moon, interesting and new as the moon is. It is in trying to understand where our history, trying to understand how the solar system got made and how it works now. And from this point of view, I'm just as happy to be studying the history of the sun and just as happy that other colleagues are getting samples of the sun out of the moon in their laboratories as I am that we're finding out things about the moon itself.
I'm Johannes Geis from the University of Bern, Switzerland. Again, also, I'm, of course, speaking for a large number of people. We didn't try to form an acronym, and I think it would be difficult because we would have to put some umlaut into this acronym, and you would have a hard time to pronounce them. Interest of the three of us here overlaps to some extent, but it was mentioned that our group has been particularly interested in studying solar wind composition. And we have been able to have two approaches here. One is to use the lunar surface as a target and as a collector. And there, of course, you collect solar wind particles, what we think over 500 million years or so. At the same time, we have been able to collect the solar wind on an aluminum sheet for 77 minutes. And this, of course, gives us some numbers on the composition of this solar wind as we had them on the 20th or 21st of July, if take Greenwich time. And in the same time, we can compare this with the averages we have on the moon. Now, if you use the moon as the solar wind collector, there are very great difficulties. You have saturation effects, you have diffusion losses of solar wind particles, but nevertheless, you find something very interesting. And to summarize what we and the Berkeley group today has been reporting, I might say the following. We find, of course, the two helium isotopes, helium-4 and helium-3, in abundances which were not the same but guessed from certain data in meteorites. Now, with neon, we have a very strong difference between the isotopic composition in these solar wind particles and on the terrestrial isotopic composition of neon. These might, a possibility to explain this difference is by escape of neon in a gravitational field. The interesting thing then is that argon and krypton, the next two noble gases in the sequence of mass, are very similar in the sun and on the earth, whereas xenon is very different again. And I don't think anybody can understand this yet. We also find some differences between the present-day composition of the solar wind and the averaged-out composition in the lunar material. And this is to be expected because the solar wind, the mechanics of the solar wind is such that you would expect large differences, large fractionations, and we have to study to do these experiments with exposing foils for a number of times before we can come up with averages and can extrapolate compositions to the sun.
Okay, we're now ready to take questions. We'll ask you again to please wait for the mic following raising your hand, and if you would, whenever possible, address your question to a specific individual. It will help us in preparing the transcript. Earl Ubel.
Dr. Geis, did you have any difficulty in cleaning dust off the foils that you got?
I would say it's an understatement to say we had some difficulties. We had great difficulties. You must compare the exposure times of the dust to the solar wind with the foil. I don't know if you saw the presentation today. The dust particles have been exposed to the solar wind for more than 300 years. The foil was 77 minutes. There you end up with a factor more than 1 million. But we have been able to clean portions of the Apollo 11 dust sufficiently, and we are in the process of cleaning other portions, so we are getting good data. And in fact, one paper has been published in Science in the December 18 issue, where we in particular showed that we have been able to clean the dust and get the data out of the soil.
Is that because of the handling by the astronauts, or?
Oh no! In fact, we can be extremely satisfied with the small amount of dust we had on that soil. With the naked eye, when I opened the package in the lunar receiving lab behind the barrier, I couldn't see any dust. And as I say, a surface coverage of the dust, with dust of 1 in 10 million, would foul up our experiment. So you just cannot, these are so small amounts of dust, you cannot see them. But we still need some special cleaning to get it off.
Harry, please.
Both Professor Walker and Professor Arnold to dig a little bit on the idea of, you have rock samples for 4.5 billion years back, that is, usable samples, some from 3.6, some now in the 2.5 billion year range. These are substantial portions of the age of the sun. And would you expect to see differences in solar flare activity or solar activity in these different major time periods? Or have you seen such things?
I could comment on that. The difficulty is, of course, that the solar particles penetrate only a small distance. And so anytime a rock finds itself below the surface, even a few centimeters, it's shielded off from the solar radiations. So the only time you're recording solar radiations is for the time the rock is on the surface. That time, from our measurements and a combination of the measurements that we make and other people have made, is small compared to the total lifetime of the rock. You see, the rock was formed as part of a melt, then it got broken out, and that was sometime later. Then after it got broken out, it got worked probably below the surface, then reemerged and got deposited on the surface, etc. Every time it came onto the surface, there was a window opened up. And during that period of time, you were able to look at the sun's radiations. None of these samples, what we have now, in the rocks that we have now, are essentially the rocks that were on the surface recently. And all of us are looking at recent solar activity. That is relatively recent, like 10 million years. What we would be delighted to have, what we're most interested to have in the future, are samples collected from different depths below the surface, from fresh craters, from old craters, and by finding out when they were covered over, at what period of time ago they were covered over, we would have a window to what the solar activity was doing at that time. Now, do I think there are apt to be any differences? That's very hard to say. It is my hunch that there will be differences in the solar activity, simply because the solar activity is an erratic kind of an effect. Now, in spite of that, over 10 million years, apparently, it has not been very different. And it's anybody's guess as to whether 70 million years ago or 700 million years ago, it was very different. My guess, my hunch is that it will be.
Let me comment, too, on that. I think there are a couple of points of perspective here. One of them is the differences we've seen that Mr. Walker is talking about, things being erratic. One example of this erraticness is that the last solar cycle, the one that culminated in the IGY in 1958, was far more intense than any other cycle in the previous, in terms of sunspot counts. In the previous 200 and some odd years, the thing had been observed. It also produced individual flares that were more than 10 times as big as anything we've seen since. And in fact, the average for the period, the present period, I think perhaps fortunately for space exploration, has been quite substantially lower than the average of the previous period. Another point in this direction is simply the nature of the events themselves. All of the isotopes that I was talking about up there, as having been produced recently, produced in any important way by three or four events. The cobalt-56 excess, which is the most striking thing. You could forget everything, but something that happened for 2 days on April 12th. Now, that's quite different from the steady cosmic radiation coming to us from the outside, which sweeps through the whole galaxy and averages completely out, and we see cute little 10% differences, which people get very excited about. Here's something that just doesn't exist at all, except maybe a few days a year at most. So there's been some reason to think that it could be variable. all we know now, I think, is that on this 10-million-year scale, a very slow scale, things are changing, we don't see any gross variations. I certainly haven't given up trying to see finer variations. The only reason I didn't dare to talk about them today is because I have noticed that our views about these subtler variations change pretty sharply on a half-life scale of 1 week. And since I suspect that that's still going on, I thought I would rather not retract later what I happen to believe today. And we'll let this go for a little while until we really get firm with it. But there may be such changes.
Ed Gillard. Would you expect to be able to see in your so-called trapped record a history of Iraq that had been exposed and then buried for a significant period of time and then re-exposed? Would you get two distinct intervals of records that would be recognizable if you came across such a thing? And have you seen anything that looked at all like
that?
Yes.
I don't know whether you caught the interchange when Dr. Fleischer, who's another tracked expert, asked me a question as to whether I didn't agree with him that we recognized four different events now in the history of Rock 17, and I sort of kiddingly said that, well, maybe it's only three, and maybe one of the things we're seeing ain't so. But we're already, I think, seeing pretty clear evidence that when one group of techniques is brought to bear, things look one way, another group another way. This is the obvious interpretation. I don't think there's any question about the data. I think there's good agreement, and obviously first-class guys are doing the work. I think the answer is yes. We can see such things. I think we're already beginning to see.
Do you think what you're already beginning to see, my understanding of the way you described what you're already beginning to see, might be individual solar events as opposed to individual buryings of a given rock? Can you differentiate between the two there?
Yes. I think we can differentiate between the two. It's pretty tangled right now and certainly isn't made any clearer by all the phenomena we're throwing at you all at one time. But I think there were a number of key observations. I mean, one was the track observation that the rock has high counts on the outside all over, whereas in the radioactivity observation, all the high stuff is on one side. Well, an obvious interpretation has been tumbled. The track counts extending over many millions of years, and radioactivity over comparatively few millions of years. Then there's this question of the production deep in the rock and the two possible interpretations of that the rock has been buried deep, or perhaps that the solar particles have been different in the past. So those are examples of attempts to disentangle this kind of effect.
Where are you, Beth? Is it possible by this technique to determine whether the solar flux has been changing on the order of thousands of years?
In principle, absolutely yes. There is one very important isotope, carbon-14. Carbon-14 dating on the Earth, with which I once had something to do, is a very productive technique which has shown very interesting variations. That is, when you try to date the wood from an old pyramid, when we did it very crudely in the old days, it fit very well. But now that people do it much better, you see wiggles in the curve, and these geophysical wiggles have caused much discussion. They're terribly interesting. They also have a practical effect on the application of this technique to understanding the chronology. I think it's very important. I regret that we weren't able to do this on 11. My colleague Hans Seuss, who's a co-investigator on our group, is one who would very much like to do this on 12. I think that we may be able to understand both things better if we can tie the carbon dating variations to any excesses of the same isotope with the same 5,000-year half-life seen on the moon.
Any further questions?
Why not? No, excuse me, maybe a word of explanation there. The carbon-14 you see on the Earth is made by a very specific and unique mechanism of capture of neutrons in the Earth's atmosphere. Carbon-14 is undoubtedly made in lunar rocks, it's certainly made in meteorites, by a different reaction on the oxygen in the oxides of the rock. So it's not the same process, but it produces the same isotope. And it will certainly be there. I think we can predict roughly how much.
Professor Walker, correct me if I'm wrong. Were you the gentleman today who mentioned the 1 mil of erosion in a million years, 1 millimeter?
Yes.
Would you elaborate on just on that subject of the amount of erosion in that time?
Just a little more in layman's
terms. I want to get a tape clip out of it, frankly.
Well, again, the basic guide, the number is about 1 millimeter per million years. Now, that's a very crude number at the moment. And the reason partly that it's crude is the lack of information, detailed information, on the low-energy solar flares. There are two ways to get at the number. Both have the same basic idea behind them. That is, that certain kinds of radiation penetrate very deeply and are not affected very much by a little bit of erosion. Others penetrate not so deeply and would begin to be affected by erosion, and other radiations penetrate hardly at all and would be very much affected by erosion. In our case, we compare proton ages. These are things that result from a high-energy penetrating component with things we measure for very heavy nuclei. Very heavy nuclei penetrate much less. If you get a difference between these two ages, then you have some erosion. You do get a difference, and it's 1 millimeter per million years, about.
What do you mean by erosion?
Please. How do you define erosion for us laymen?
I define it in the way I did today. I said it's equivalent to the removal of one layer of these little grains that go to make up the rock, which are about 100 microns, which is about 4,000ths of an inch, okay? It's equivalent to the removal of one of these grain layers about every 50,000 years or so. No, they get knocked off. They either get knocked off by micrometeorite impact. That's the favorite mechanism for erosion by some people. These surfaces of these rocks have impact craters, which you can just see with the naked eye. These are the so-called Zapp pits. And they have impact craters that you can see in a stereo scan electron microscope on that scale. Fantastically beautiful. So that these impact features exist and have certainly contributed to the wearing away of the rock. Now, there are other possibilities as well. The rocks on the moon are obviously heated, cooled, shaken every now and then. And you can imagine that these little grains, which are not too well held in some of these rocks, would just flake off. There may be other processes as well. But it's the removal of the material and distributing it out into the fine powder.
Hey, please.
In the parley that just broke up, Tom Gold seemed to equate this this rate of erosion with the rate of dust buildup, and consider the dust accumulation the same speed. Do you see a one-to-one relationship there too?
No. What he was talking about is that you have two problems. You have rocks, and they're obviously rounded. And you have rocks that come from craters that were obviously thrown out. His argument goes as follows. You have rocks that come from craters that are strewn out in lines. They obviously came from these places. And you can calculate and show that when they landed, boom, they must have landed in an angle, and they must have produced a trench. Okay? But now if you look at them, if you look at the place where the trench ought to be, you don't see it. So the trench has gotten filled in. Yet if you look at the rock is sitting there clean as a whistle. There's hardly any dust on the surface of the rock. And somehow you've got two processes going on. You may have removal of stuff from the rock, cleaning of the rock, and at the same time you've got to redistribute material in the pond. I think you could do that by several different mechanisms, but clearly the processes are not well understood.
Okay, it's been a long, long day. Let's take about two more questions and end it, Jim Schechter.
Yeah, and this same subject, how would that correlate, for instance, with the rather heavy dust layer that built up on Surveyor, where we've seen pictures of a very discernible dust layer 4 or 5 feet above the ground that's built up in 31 months?
I honestly don't know. Certainly the Surveyor materials are different than the lunar rocks. Particles may stick. I just don't know. I have not looked at the results, and I think that's an interesting idea, as a matter of fact.
Art Schneider.
Mr. Anders said this morning he didn't feel that this moon rock program would do anything towards solving the question of the origin of the solar system. You would certainly disagree with that.
I
Did he really say that?
Yes. He said there's nothing here we aren't learning, especially on ages, from meteorites.
I didn't remember so strong a statement. I would emphatically disagree. I certainly, for myself, I think we're learning a great deal. The great difference, I've just jumped in here. Anyone got a comment? The great difference, it seems to me, between the meteorites and the moon, and I speak as an enthusiast for meteorites like Dr. Anders, I've worked on the subject assiduously for 10 years or more, is that we do not know where the meteorites come from. We do not know what their surface features are like because every one of them we see is cleaned off on the outside by the time we get it. We don't know. We talk about the complexities of the history of the rock on the surface. We at least know that it's been the Earth's distance from the sun. We know what body it's been sitting on. We know roughly how long. Our ignorance about the meteorites, somebody once put it, that it's like trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle with one piece in a million of the jigsaw puzzle in your hand. We've learned an immense amount from the meteorites. I think most of the people that you see on the platform have cut their teeth on meteorites. But I think what we're learning from the moon is immensely more because it is the first time we've had an object that we knew something about, you know, where it came from and where the things were. I think we're likely to make progress, you know, whatever word quantitative terms mean, you know, 10 times faster with the moon material than we ever were with the meteorites.
Can you wait just a second? What would you do with a meteorite that didn't intersect the Earth's atmosphere? Suppose you could bring it back.
Somebody, NASA went out and kindly grabbed one. Well, I think I'd have to fight with my friends and many other people. It would be very interesting. But there are a lot of measurements that we would like to do with it because, again, we would have the exposed surface, which is now lacking. But it would not have the other advantages that the lunar samples would have. That is to say, I would still not know what its place of origin was. Even if I knew its orbit, I wouldn't know what its orbit had been in the past. This is another long story. But it would still be something that I'd have to find out about in the future when people landed on asteroids or comets or somewhere and found out that that's where these objects came from, and I could then put this into their place in the solar system. What's happening now, we've got an immense amount of really floating information.
Well, thank you very much.
Dr. Walker, you are.